Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Adam Goodhart, author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening.
Deep down, Lincoln was thinking of this crisis as an opportunity to move the country beyond this stain of slavery.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. A panel discussion on the role of poetry in the modern world.
Well, does poetry cause people to mount the barricades? Does poetry cause people to change what they order in restaurants?
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news.
The Book Review podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
It's the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War, the most traumatic experience in American history, and there are many books being published on the subject, but perhaps the most remarkable one is called 1861, The Civil War Awakening. Its author is Adam Goodhart. It's reviewed on the cover of this week's book review by the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Debbie Applegate, who says, like many of the best works of history, 1861 creates the uncanny illusion that the reader has stepped into a time machine. She says a Goodhart's book is filled with fascinating figures who have been forgotten but should be remembered today. I'm delighted that Adam is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay, America in 1861, what was it like?
This is one of those moments in history that the only certainty was uncertainty itself. Everything was up for grabs. And that had to do with even more than just the Civil War. It was a moment when there were so many changes going on in technology, changes going on in science and religion. I found one person writing at the time in a little village out in Ohio and remembering after the war that it was a moment when the very air seemed surcharged with electric energy.
Adam, one of the things you've done so brilliantly, and Debbie Applegate comments on this, is really give us a kind of panorama and almost a travelogue through America at that period. Tell us about some of the great figures whose act, sometimes almost improvised, really changed the course of history. For instance, Benjamin Franklin Butler. Who was he?
Well, you know, I love these little moments when things sort of pivot on a dime and history changes. And one of those moments came in late May of 1861. So we're just about a month into the Civil War, a month after Fort Sumter. This commander, Benjamin Franklin Butler, Union commander, in charge of a Union fort deep within Confederate territory in Virginia, and three escaped African-American slaves come to the gate of the fort and ask for asylum. And he's faced with this situation where he has to decide what to do. He's been told this is not a war against slavery. You're to enforce the federal laws, including fugitive slave codes.
No Emancipation Proclamation.
No, this is a year and a half before the Emancipation Proclamation. And yet here are these three young men. They've been conscripted to work on the Confederate fortifications. How can he simply send them back to the southern side? And in fact, he makes a sort of improvised seat-of-the-pants decision to take them into the fort, and he ends up actually sort of becoming the great emancipator more than Lincoln himself was.
And what did he do? He actually came up with a kind of legalistic way to reinterpret the role, the place of African Americans in the South.
Yeah, General Butler was a lawyer in private life, and he was a sort of a very good, tricky, slippery Massachusetts lawyer. And so he's thinking about the fugitive slave codes. He's thinking about these three young slaves. And he realizes his way out of this dilemma is to accept at face value the Southern contention that these people are property. And he says, if they are property, I can declare them contraband goods, contraband of war, which is a legal term in military law, meaning that they are property that's being used by the enemy for belligerent purposes. So he realizes he could just confiscate them as if he were intercepting a shipment of muskets or swords. And that's what he does. Now, of course, as in fact the New York Times said, this is contraband property that has legs to walk with. So pretty soon, hundreds and then even thousands of other escaped slaves are coming into the Union lines there and throughout the South.
Well, Adam, if the war was not supposed to be about slavery, and Abraham Lincoln said this in his first inaugural when 7 states, I think, had already seceded from the Union, what was it about?
It was one of those moments that that single instant of the attack on Fort Sumter brought together people from many different creeds and many different persuasions. It was sort of brilliant. You know, one of the things that's extraordinary about Lincoln is that he was able to speak sort of both to, as we would frame it, the conservatives and the conservative tradition in America, and also the sort of what we might call today the liberal or progressive tradition. So Lincoln could say that this was a war for preserving the Union, preserving the Constitution, and people would rally to the standard for that reason. But there were also people rallying from the other direction, people who were abolitionists who saw this as a chance for the slaves to win their freedom. So, you know, we tend to try to reduce the Union cause, the Confederate cause, to one thing. And in fact, I think as in all wars, it's many things. It was many things to many people. You know, when we think about wars in our own time, the reasons that people go off and fight aren't often these sort of neat, clear-cut ideological reasons. There's often politics that plays in. There's ideology. There can be sort of personal ambition. There can be religious feeling. There's a whole lot that feeds into that decision. And I think we don't do the people of the 1860s justice when we try to reduce that.
And one final thing, Adam, there is a big argument you make in the book for all the narrative splendor and fun and entertainment in it. And that has to do with the vision Lincoln had of how America was actually going to be reborn, become a new nation, an idea that was very much debated and discussed. And what's behind that? How did he do this, and what did he say?
The Lincoln I write about is a Lincoln who really changes and evolves. During the first chapters of my book, he's sort of bumbling and stumbling his way through the secession crisis and making a lot of mistakes and a lot of gaffes. But he sets a date, July 4th, for Congress to reconvene, and he's going to send a special message to Congress on Independence Day. And about 2 months before the date, he just dives into writing this message to Congress to an extent that strikes those closest to him as very, very strange. Here's a great military and political crisis unfolding, and what is the President of the United States doing but sitting and writing draft after draft after draft? What he does is he sets out a justification for why this war is being fought. And as he sees it, secession is anarchy. The very essence of secession is anarchy. If you are able to withdraw from a political compact at the moment that anything starts going against you, that can only devolve into a total breakdown of the democratic system. He is envisioning a new union with sort of a renewed compact, one that will also include in it all sorts of people who weren't necessarily included before. He uses a phrase that's very telling. He talks about the purpose of democratic government being to give each citizen an unfettered start in the race of life. The race of life, of course, to me really evokes Darwin and this moment of 1861, just after the publication of The Origin of Species.
Of competition and survival.
Exactly. Social competition, survival, a world that Lincoln had grown up in which only the strong survive, and he struggled his way to the top. Then he uses this word, an unfettered start. And actually, if you look at his drafts, he had struck out the word an even start, and he had put in an unfettered start, which, you know, as a metaphor doesn't work as well. You think of a start in a race being even rather than unfettered. And a few people noticed this and said, unfettered. He's using the language of slavery there. He's thinking of slavery, and I think he was. I think that deep down, Lincoln was thinking of this crisis as an opportunity to move the country beyond this stain of slavery. And there are instances that I discovered that really haven't been picked up before of him early in 1861, early in the war, hinting at the idea that he might eventually end up doing something like issuing the Emancipation Proclamation.
Thanks so much, Adam.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Adam Goodhart, whose new book, 1861, The Civil War Awakening, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review.
The Book Review Podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives by Stephen Levy. The New York Times Book Review says the book sheds light on the biggest threats Google faces today, from the Chinese government to Facebook and privacy critics. That's Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So what is Amazon up to now?
Amazon has made an announcement that's very interesting to people in the library world. They said this week that they're going to open up their Kindle device to ebooks that are available from the library. This also applies to the Kindle app, which is, of course, on iPad, iPhone, smartphones. And this is a huge deal because until now, if you wanted to download a free ebook from your local library, you couldn't do it on the Kindle. You had to do it on Barnes & Noble's Nook, the Sony Reader, the Kobo Reader, or your laptop or smartphone.
So this seems to be good news. What brought Amazon around?
Well, Amazon put out a statement saying that they're very excited that now millions of Kindle customers will be able to borrow Kindle books. They didn't really explain why they decided to do this, but one theory is that they were a little threatened by the popularity of the Nook. The Nook, since it made its debut in 2009, was always open to library books. And in the last year especially, library ebooks have become a very, very big deal. At the New York Public Library, the demand for ebooks has increased by about 35% just in the last year. And as more people get e-readers, they're realizing that they don't have to buy ebooks. They can just, from home or from the office, download free ebooks as long as they have a library card.
Julie, when will this go into effect? Is there a lot of kind of technical stuff that has to happen, or if I have a Kindle, can I just do it right now?
You have to wait until later this year. Amazon has not set a date. And they're going to provide ebooks through Overdrive, which is one of the companies that works as kind of an intermediary between publishers and libraries. Libraries pay a licensing fee to Overdrive. Overdrive pays the publishers, and then libraries pay a certain fee for acquiring an ebook for their collection. Usually it's a little bit more than what you would pay for an ebook on your Kindle at a retail price.
And what about borrowing rules? I know this has come up in the expiration of books and such. Once I've borrowed this on my Kindle, it's permanently borrowed, or do I have to, so to speak, return it to the library?
It's just like a print book from the library, actually. Libraries can set their own borrowing terms, and a pretty standard borrowing term is you check out the book. You can, of course, do this remotely, and then it's your book for 2 weeks. It pops up into your Kindle or whatever device you're using, and then after the, say, two-week borrowing period, it expires and just disappears from your device.
Julie, what impact is this having on the publishing industry? Have they reacted to this transformation, this news from Amazon?
Well, most publishers already make their ebooks available in libraries, so I'm sure they're delighted that they'll have even wider distribution. But there are two of the big six publishers, Macmillan and Simon & Schuster, that still don't make their ebooks available in libraries. So this may put a little bit more pressure on them to do so.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Last week, I moderated a conversation about the role of poets and poetry today. It was held at the Housing Works Used Books Cafe in celebration of National Poetry Month and in special acknowledgement of a new book by our poetry critic, David Orr. It's called Beautiful and Pointless, A Guide to Modern Poetry. Joining me in the panel were David Orr, Dwight Garner, daily book critic for The New York Times, Tree Swenson, director of the Academy of American Poets, and Robin Creswell, poetry editor of the Paris Review. The conversation, surprisingly, turned rather quickly to politics, and in particular to a poem by Robert Haas, former poet laureate of the United States. The poem is called Bush's War, and here are some relevant lines from it. It's a taste for power that permits people to believe that the dead women in the rubble of Baghdad who did not cast a vote for their deaths are being given the gift of freedom. So let's start. I pose to our distinguished panelists here a very famous dichotomy that you can find in the history of criticism about poetry, which is one of the things we'll discuss tonight. And that some of you will remember Percy Bysshe Shelley's great, maybe the greatest essay ever written in defense of poetry, in which he said, "Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world," to which W.H. Auden replied a couple of centuries later, "Sounds to me like the secret police." And Auden, you'll remember, said, "Poetry makes nothing happen." So I'll start with David, whose book is called Beautiful and Pointless, and ask him, does poetry really make nothing happen? And if so, is that a good thing?
Poetry makes things happen in the way that almost anything makes things happen. You know, no poem that gets read is read without effect. So, I mean, what people are really talking about when they say, well, does poetry make anything happen, is things like, well, does poetry cause people to mount the barricades? Does poetry cause people to change what they order in restaurants? And I think it, you know, it varies from poem to poem and from place to place. So one of the problems that you have in all discussions of poetry is this sort of increasing reliance on these high levels of abstraction where we say, well, what does poetry do? Well, I know what poetry does. I mean, individual poems do different things. I mean, there have been poems that cause people to feel more inclined to take different political positions. So in that sense, those poems certainly made something happen. There have been poems that just made me feel kind of happy. I mean, that's something. So again, it depends on what you think is happening and what would constitute nothing happening.
Dwight, you look ready to say something.
I was just reading David's book on the way in, and he has an elegant destruction of a Robert Haas poem that sort of wants to be political, and you sort of say it might not be. Can you talk a bit about that poem and why you singled it out?
It's specifically in the context of political poetry and what it means to write a political poem. And one of the things that I'm trying to bring up in the discussion is the idea of audience. You know, who are you addressing if you want to write a political poem? The point that I'm trying to make with reference to this Robert Haas poem is that the poem is largely addressed to an audience of poets who already agree with Robert Haas about almost everything that he's saying. And so to that extent, even though the poem is using political language, it's not having much of a political effect.
David, what are the things he's saying that his audience would agree with?
I'll tell you, the title of the poem is Bush's War. It's opposed to the Iraq War. I mean, I happen to agree with Robert Haas, but a lot of what he's saying, but at the same time, it's a foregone conclusion that most of his audience is going to agree with him. So to that extent, he's not necessarily challenging people in the way that he might otherwise do if he were to sort of alter his language a bit. And then I compare the poem to a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks that I think actually is a somewhat more effective political poem. I actually think Robert Haas is a very good poet. And the reason that the poem is in the book is because I think he is a good poet, and so he's sort of worth discussing. And it's interesting to watch someone who is a good writer struggle with the issues that we're talking about. One of the problems is actually finding a position to speak from that has any kind of authority. And I think poets, in many cases, rightly, are sort of nervous about authority, so they back away from it. But the problem is, the cleaner you keep your hands, the harder it is to use them to do anything. You end up in a fairly isolated position surrounded by other people who are equally isolated, and you write poems to them with titles like Bush's War.
Well, David, let me mention something else, and we'll go directly to questions. Another poem you write about is a poem that Joseph Brodsky said was the greatest poem of the 20th century, which is September 1, 1939. Sit here in one of the dives in 52nd Street, anxious and alone, uncertain and afraid. That's entirely about politics, right? It's about World War II. It's about the German invasion of Poland, beginning of World War II. So what is it that Auden is able to do that Haas was not?
You know, it's a good question because, yeah, it's about World War II, but then when September 11th came, it ended up being somehow about September 11th. I mean, it got emailed to everybody. People talked about it. People cited it.
You mean Auden's poem?
Right, yeah. Exactly, Auden's poem. And one thing to remember about that poem is that Auden couldn't stand that poem. The later Auden didn't like it at all. And Auden, we can debate about how good his judgment was about his own early work when he became an older man, but he was always a pretty serious thinker. And, I mean, in his opinion, what he was doing in that poem was a kind of propaganda, and he sort of later denounced it. I mean, I still think it's a great poem, but his position was that, you know, again, the famous statement of poetry making nothing happen, but he specifically later didn't like the kind of event-tied poetry that he had written when he was younger. He thought it was sort of soapboxy and unwise.
Is it the job of the poet, the critic, to get more people to read poetry?
It's one of the jobs a poetry critic can have. There are a lot of jobs poetry critics can have. I mean, spreading the word about things, part of it can be trying to increase the audience, part of it can be trying to decrease the audience, part of it could be just sort of passing judgment, part of it can be being a polemicist. I mean, there's criticism has a lot of aspects, so I think that's one of the aspects, and it's one that people get very nervous about for some reason.
David, you make the point in the book, and I think make it brilliantly, that poetry is just one among many, many, many kinds of human activities, and there's something of a sense of crusading about those of us who love poetry. We seem to have this sense that everyone should be reading it. But in fact, like any other art form, we're never going to reach 100% saturation of the audience, but yet we feel compelled to try to reach more people with poetry because it's touched something so deeply in ourselves. My organization, the Academy of American Poets, started National Poetry Month, and it is April, National Poetry Month. And it has come under fire for wanting to limit poetry somehow to 1 month instead of all year round, which was, of course, not the intention. We're perfectly happy that now we don't even do many readings in April because there are too damn many readings in April for us to do readings.
David, let me ask you a question about the reading of poetry that your book gets to, which is, does someone have to learn how to read a poem, how to read a serious poem?
I guess so, but not in the way that you would learn how to, you know, build a birdhouse or something. You know, poetry is a practice. It's not exactly like learning to play or appreciate soccer, but it's closer to that than learning to, you know, repair a washing machine. So you have to learn to appreciate the context in which you're receiving information. And that's which is why in the introduction I start comparing it to foreign travel. You know, the idea of going to somewhere you haven't been and getting the hang of a situation that you're unfamiliar with.
Dwight, you write a fair amount of criticism in the daily newspaper about poetry. How conscious are you of your audience when you do it? And do you approach writing about a book of poems differently from the way you would the other books you did?
Well, you're conscious of the audience to the extent that it's hard to review a book of poetry. It's not hard. No one would prevent me, and I shouldn't prevent myself, but it's hard to find a book of poetry to review negatively in the New York Times. And by that, I mean, negative poetry reviews famously are quite rare because so few people read poetry. You're in the position of saying, you know that thing you never heard of? Well, it's terrible. And so this is this awkward...
People write about my books that way.
I know David's aware of this as well. And you go through the books and try to find unknown poets to champion. But it's hard to find mid-range poets that you want. They want the attention, but you don't want to take up the space to say, this is not worth reading. Poetry suffers a bit from too much championing, I think. And reviewers respond to negative reviews of poetry because they feel like someone is attending to actuality. They're telling the truth because all readers don't like all poetry, and yet everything they hear about poetry is so positive.
Dwight, what about this question of narrative? Do you actually structure a review differently when you're writing about it? How do you decide what you're going to emphasize? How do you link the themes together?
Well, it's the same way David writes. I assume you take notes and you think about what this poet is trying to say. You take note of the language. You know, one of the great things about reading good poems, and it's very easy. There's a deep secret David knows, that it's easy to review poems because you quote the poem, and it takes up half the damn space. Because, you know, it's just, if you quote a few times, really you only have to write about 300 words in an 800-word review because that little quote eats up, you know, the space that would normally require 400 words. But quoting well is very important, I think, in terms of getting readers to care about poetry because the stuff is there. Readers just don't know where to find it. And the way to convince them to read poetry is not often you screaming and lighting your hair on fire or what was used to be your hair on fire. It's quoting extremely well. And David's a master at that. And I try to do that.
That was an excerpt from our conversation last week at Housing Works. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, celebrities continue to rule the nonfiction list. Tina Fey is still on top with Bossy Pants. And now we've got Shirley MacLaine back with yet another memoir. It lands at number 3. It's called I'm Over All That. Are her readers? Maybe not. Sammy Hagar is still on the list. Ashley Judd is still on the list. Caroline Kennedy is on the list with a book of poetry. It's called She Walks in Beauty, not poems by her, some of her favorite poems. And down at number 14, we've got Barbara Eden. Remember her? She's got a memoir. It's called Genie Out of the Bottle. And interestingly, right above her, we have a sort of political philosopher celebrity, Francis Fukuyama. His latest book is called The Origins of Political Order. And if Francis Fukuyama and Barbara Eden doesn't sound like a crack team on Dancing with the Stars, I don't know what is.
What about fiction?
Nora Roberts is back on top with her latest. It's called Chasing Fire. It is about a smoke jumper in Montana, just in time for this year's fire season. And interestingly, I think we may have our first ever fiction bestseller translated from Korean. It's rare enough for translated books of any kind to land on the list. And I don't think I've ever seen one from Korea. This is called Please Look After Mom. The author is named Kyung Suk Shin. And she's written a number of books. This is the first one that's been translated. It was a huge hit in Korea, sold about 1.5 million copies. It is about a mother who gets lost in the subway in Seoul and her family's efforts to find her and the kind of complications in the family that are revealed. So we'll see if she can hang on until Mother's Day in a couple of weeks.
Well, that's an interesting development. Kyung Suk Shin. We'll keep an eye on her. Now, Jenny, questions have been raised. In fact, there's a considerable controversy brewing over Three Cups of Tea, Greg Mortensen's memoir about this very humanitarian project he began in Afghanistan. What's the story there?
Well, as a lot of people probably know from the 60 Minutes expose that aired last week, it seems that the memoir is embellished to a certain degree. And sort of in terms of publishing, not a new story. We've all seen James Fry, Margaret Seltzer, all these other memoirists challenged. And here it seems that Mortensen really, to kind of create this uplifting story, which has helped him raise millions of dollars to build girls' schools in Afghanistan, really sort of fuzz the details in his own story. The charge is that actually he didn't sort of stumble into this village high in the mountains of Pakistan after kind of losing his way trying to climb K2. He actually visited the village a year later after this sort of failed mountain climbing attempt. He also says in the book that he was kidnapped by Taliban on one of these trips. And now some people are saying that, in fact, this group of people he's describing were not Taliban at all. There was no Taliban in the area where he was. And in fact, they were just local tribesmen who he had sort of more or less engaged as tour guides, who were actually quite friendly hosts taking him around. One of them is now actually suing him. More seriously, you know, real questions have been raised about the finances of his charity. It's called the Central Asia Institute. It's based in Montana, where Mortensen lives. And I think they've raised something on the order of $60 million just in the last year alone to build these schools. Questions have been raised about whether or not he has built as many schools as he has claimed. The CBS segment showed one of their reporters going to some of these schools and finding these empty buildings. So it's not clear that these schools are even in use. And it's not clear whether the money to build them actually did come from Mortensen's organization.
And Jenny, there's also a publishing and, in fact, bestseller side to all of this, because leading the charge against Greg Mortensen is another very successful, admired author of nonfiction, Jon Krakauer. What has he been saying about Mortensen and about the New York Times bestseller list?
Well, he was one of the major sources for the 60 Minutes segment. And then, to just about everybody's surprise, 2 days later, he released his own 75-page ebook via Amazon Singles called Three Cups of Deceit, sort of reiterating the charges 60 Minutes had made, but sort of adding a lot of detail. Krakauer is an acquaintance of Mortensen's. They knew each other from mountain climbing circles, and obviously Krakauer spent a lot of time in that part of the world, partly researching his book about Pat Tillman, which was itself a bestseller. His book is like quite a fierce indictment, very detailed. And one thing that sort of leapt out at me, he sort of walks through these very tangled finances of the Central Asia Institute, which he sort of depicts as something of a vehicle for Mortensen's self-promotion as much as anything. And according to him, the Central Asia Institute in 2009 alone spent $1.7 million promoting Mortensen's two books, Three Cups of Tea and then Stones into Schools, which came out in 2009. So they spent about $1.7 million promoting this book, taking out ads, that kind of thing. They subsidized $1 million in Mortensen's travel. So Mortensen was out there giving speeches at, you know, $30,000, $40,000 a pop. That money almost entirely went into his own pockets, as do all of the sales from his books. I think a lot of people might have the impression that when they buy the book, they're helping to support this organization. As even Mortensen concedes, that's not true. The proceeds all go to him and to his co-writer on the first book.
Jenny, doesn't Krakauer even say that part of this enormous marketing and some of these misspent funds may have something to do with the bestseller list? Is that right?
He sort of suggests that Mortensen was, you know, certainly very aware of his position on the list. His Three Cups of Tea, incidentally, clocks its 220th week on the paperback list this week. Krakauer talks about how at a lot of his speaking events, Mortensen would distribute free copies of his book. Those books were paid for by his charity. Krakauer says that Mortensen had these books bought retail rather than directly from his publisher for wholesale prices because, one, he would get royalties that way, and two, the sales would be counted towards the bestseller list. If they're bought directly from the publisher, they're bulk sales, they are not counted. And he has an anecdote. Krakauer has an anecdote in the book saying that at one point when Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love leapt over Three Cups of Tea into the number one spot on the list, Mortensen got really upset and sent people out with the Central Asia Institute's credit card, in Krakauer's words, to buy up copies of the book to make it back to number one.
Wow, what a story. And I guess the last word still remains to be written. We don't know what all this adds up to at this
point. Yeah, Mortensen and his organization have made very minimal response. And they say because of scheduling conflicts and also because of health issues, in the past week, he went into the hospital to have a heart surgery stemming from problems related to oxygen deprivation at high altitudes.
Thanks so much, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.